June 30th, and we are meeting in without a quorum, and we're going to start with a public hearing on House Bill 2189 relating to public subsidies for health insurance. We'll start there, and then as other members arrive, we'll make our way back up the agenda. And good afternoon, Mr. King and Mr. Naughton.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is, for the record, Rocky King. I'm the administrator for the Insurance Pool Governing Board and the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. Senator Gordley, House Bill 2189, and I've provided, I believe, some testimony for you.
You have a copy for George, too, Kelly.
And basically, in summary, let me kind of start from the beginning in my words and make it a little bit more simple. When somebody applies to the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program for an individual policy and they are denied coverage by Blue Cross or Kaiser or PACC or another carrier because of health conditions, they end up in what is called the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, the state's high-risk pool. We then help subsidize the premiums for the purchase of that high-risk policy, and that can be a 95% subsidy, a 90, a 70, or a 50% subsidy. But the reality is, because of their health conditions, the cost of the actual service they receive is closer, it's closer to between $500 and $550 per month, again, because of the health conditions that those folks have. That money is made up by an assessment of health insurers. So they get $300 from us, and $200 to $250 they go out to the insurance industry and assess health insurers, which then gets passed down into the 2 million people that have health insurance policies throughout the state. And that's true for all of the 9,500 enrollments in OMIP, but what we're concerned about are the 1,000 or so that are just enrolled through FEOP, Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, with a subsidy. This bill would allow us basically to utilize federal funds to pay the full cost of care by matching the assessment dollars paid by insurers. So rather than have the insurers pay the full $200 to $250, they would end up paying approximately 30 to 40% of that. The remainder would come strictly from federal funds. So the passage of this bill would increase in no way the state general fund obligation and would, in fact, reduce insurer assessments throughout the state by about $1 million a year, while at the same time would maximize additional federal funds that would be available to the state. So that was the primary focus of this particular bill when it was introduced through the governor at the beginning of the session.
Mr. King, the federal funds match and maximum amount would increase to what?
Okay, Senator Gordley, we have not done a final fiscal impact, and the fiscal impact would be in identifying the federal funds limitation that would be required, and it would be our intent to come back with some experience to the legislature through the emergency board to ask for additional limitation increase if it were needed. But there is no state general fund limitation or state general fund actual dollars that would be required by this bill.
And members, we are hearing testimony on House Bill 2189. How many people are currently in the pool?
Senator Gordley, in the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool, we have about 9,500 that are enrolled in the pool. Of those, about 1,000 are receiving a subsidy through the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. And the average cost for one of those individuals enrolled in the pool is about $330 per month currently. About 70% are female, and the average age is about 52 years. So it's very, very low income, primarily, again, female enrollments, and it's generally in the almost 50% of the folks enrolled in the pool have an age above 55.
And you said, again, mostly a female clientele.
Madam Chair, in the FEOP enrollees, about 70% are female. For the other 8,500 folks enrolled in the pool without a subsidy, it's closer to 60% female.
And what does that geographic distribution look like?
Madam Chair, I wish that I would have brought my stat pack. We can provide that because we list by county each of our enrollments in both the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, but also with the Oregon Medical Insurance Pool. With the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, I think you'll see that you have the biggest area where there is a discrepancy between enrollment and individuals is Multnomah County. We have fewer enrollments than what would be expected in Multnomah County, but higher enrollments down through the valley and the southern coastal area. Eastern Oregon, I think, pretty much matches to the population percentage of distribution. We also compare those to the percent of uninsured population. So you really have two comparisons. One, how many people live in a particular area, but secondly, how many people are uninsured and what's our penetration of those uninsured.
Mm-hmm. In your written text, and thank you, you indicate that this would require no additional state funds, but you also indicate that this approach would remove unnecessary barriers to enrolling children in the program. Could you expand on that? What's the current reality and what shifts or changes as a result
of... Madam Chair, I need to look at the context of... It's on 2189. Madam Chair, there are four amendments or five amendments that were made in on the House side, and that's what I believe that was referring to. And if you look at the third page of my testimony... you'll see where we have changes in definition of family, which is the third paragraph down, and also we have another one, which is definition of health plan. Those are two that really focus on children. In changes of definition of family, the way our statutes were previously written, we could not count grandchildren that were living with their grandparents as a part of the family and subsidize them through a grandparent policy. So we've changed our definition of family so to ensure that children who are living with their grandparents are able to be a part of a plan, a family plan with their grandparent. The other is in the changes in definition of health plan, which is the fourth paragraph on the third page. We ran into cases, for example, where someone lived in Oregon, child lived in Oregon with the mother, and the child was covered by a health plan of a parent that lived in another state. If they lived in Texas, and this is a real live example, if they lived in Texas and they were enrolled in an HMO plan, they had technically... They did have insurance, so they were not eligible for a subsidy in Oregon. But the fact was, if you were in an HMO in Texas and lived in Oregon, you have no access to care. So what we basically have done is change our definition of health plan to ensure that even though a child may have had health insurance in the last 6 months, if that really having that health insurance didn't mean they could get access to care, then we wouldn't count it against them. So the reference to this will help children in terms of access to coverage, it is really just getting those kids that fall through the cracks because of the definitions that sometimes we put in statutes that or administrative rules for that matter that kind of excludes them.
And Mr. King, your last bullet on the front page of the written testimony indicates that this bill would allow the agency to pursue repayment to the fullest extent possible in cases where fraud is suspected. Would you please elaborate on that?
Yeah, Madam Chair, and that really speaks to, again, the third page in the last paragraph. We use the word fraudulent in misrepresentation in the statute right now. The problem we've run into that is that there are seven specific criteria that a district attorney's office, for example, or the attorney general's office must look at when determining whether something is fraudulent in a misrepresentation situation. we have found it very difficult to get district attorneys, our local jurisdictions, court systems, to assist us in collecting payment because of the time that it takes and the investment they have to make in determining whether or not it was fraudulent. So what we're basically doing is delinking misrepresentation from fraudulent. If somebody misrepresents something on the application, we don't have to go through a court and drag them through the courts to ask them for repayment. We can simply ask them based on misrepresentation for payment without having to go through a court system, and that has been reluctant to pursue these cases because of the time it takes for sometimes very low return.
Over the life of the program, has there been a big problem with fraud, or would you characterize it?
Madam Chair, and I'll ask Craig Kuhn, who is the manager of the program, to kind of come up here and make sure I'm right on this, but I do not believe when we first started the agency and the first testimony I gave, I said if we could keep fraud below 2% of enrollments, we would be very happy. I think we have far exceeded that. And Craig, can you introduce yourself and tell them what our experience has been in terms of recruitment of funds?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Craig Kuhn, Program Manager for the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. And so far, our fraud rate has been well below even 1% of our population. We are just sort of anticipating growth in the future and wanting to make sure that we're prepared to address that should that grow, but right now it's under 1%.
All right. Thank you very much for that information. Mr. King, you also on page 3 have a paragraph that talks about changes in permanent resident language that would, or this bill would put us in compliance with the federal government. Could you talk more about what has been the problem, or how would you characterize why we need to do this?
Yeah, Madam Chair, this is really a technical adjustment. We have in our statutes a definition of resident to basically say you're not only a resident, but you intend to stay here. And based on the federal government and Department of Human Services and the Medicaid program, that really is not something that we can require somebody in terms of a residency requirement. We can require that they live here. We just can't ask that they intend to permanently remain here. The fact of the matter is if somebody moves out of the state, they would lose the subsidy anyway. So this would have no appreciable impact other than it gets us in line with federal requirements under the definition of residency.
What is the specific language that we would be replacing?
And Chair, if we turn to House Bill 2189... Craig, do you have a page on that? I just have to find it here. It's not in bold, it's in brackets is the problem, and I got looking for my brackets. Craig, do you have the brackets?
Page 5. Number 8. Permanently.
Which
line? 26. Here we go. It is, Madam Chair, on page 5, line 26.
Permanently.
Okay. No, resident means an individual who demonstrates to the Insurance Pool Governing Board that the individual is lawfully residing in Oregon and intends to reside in Oregon, and we've taken out the bracket that says permanently. Okay. they still, upon the application, must say they're a resident of Oregon, intend to stay in Oregon. They're not here just for one day, but we're not asking them to say they have to be here permanently.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Yes, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So a follow-up to that, how do you police it?
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, in police in terms of residency, well, first of all of our clients generally make a premium in the individual market, make a premium payment to us. So we're billing them. They're sending money back to us. We know what those billing addresses are. We see what those, we run our own cashiering now. We see where those checks are coming from. In terms of an employer, you know where the employer is. Now, are there people that live in Washington and across the, you know, the line or in the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program? The only way we can tell that is, again, by the mail and the addresses that we have that go back and forth. When they apply to us, we ask for verification. That can be a driver's license. That can be a rent receipt, you know, something to show on paper, and they make copies of it that come to us. If there are a legal non-citizen, for example, although it's a small population now for us because we're using federal funds and you can't use it for some of those folks, we do get copies of any green cards or so we feel pretty comfortable that those folks are getting the program are within the state.
Representative Scott, did you have an additional question?
You know, I just had some problem with removing the word permanent to the degree that if, in fact, we are trying to police it so that, you know, that doesn't occur, it seems to me we allow more flexibility. It allows more opportunity for it to occur.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, we didn't have a problem with it either. It was a federal requirement as a part of receiving federal funds.
Senator Morris, just checking.
Thank you. I did have a question.
Please.
So you're reading my mind. The reference that you made to, you know, checking for fraud, are those the same indexes that you use to come up with a less than 1% figure for fraud?
Madam Chair, Senator Morris. Fraud can, let's say somebody misrepresents their income, and we find that out for a variety. We do what's called directed audits and random audits. We have an audit group that on a random basis pulls files, and this is an art, not necessarily a science. I mean, these folks just begin to get a feel by looking at a person's income taxes, by looking at the application to see, is there something that you know, sticks out to. And sometimes income is left out. We usually contact those folks. I would say we always contact those folks when we redo an initial determination, and we'll ask them for an explanation. If they can't give us one that's to our satisfaction, then we will go and request that they make repayment for the subsidies that have been paid to them, whether it's for a one-year period, a two-year period, or two-month period. We'll ask for them to pay that back. That's kind of different sometimes when you have people who just make an error on an application. They leave one of the children off, and some of these families, it gets very convoluted in terms of listing the family members. That to us is not fraud. It may be representation or misrepresentation, but it is through an error as opposed to fraud. We will still ask folks to pay back money if they owe it to the state, or if we owe them money, if they should have been at a higher subsidy level, we will make that good to them too. You also have folks who change forms. We have had very few, and when Craig says less than 1%, I would dare say we've served 15,000 folks since this program has been going, and if we had more than 50, I'll look at Craig, more than 50 people who misrepresented or had fraud or whatever we want to call it, I would be very surprised. It's been less than that. We have had some folks that changed forms, or they forged an employer form showing how much was taken out of their check through on their wage statement. When some of those cases have gone forward, we've gone to the local district attorneys and asked for their assistance in pressing charges and collecting money that's past due us. We also use the Department of Revenue when someone has a judgment against them. We notify the Department of Revenue, and if they have taxes coming back, they would, of course, reimburse us through that tax system. But it has not been a major problem at all.
Okay. Senator, please.
The inclusion of members in a family dependent, 23 years of age or under, seems to be a very generous age at 23. What is the rationale for extending it?
Senator Gordley, Senator Morris, that goes basically with the typical insurance industry contract. Whether you're with PEB or whether you're with an employer plan, generally the definition is you can be a dependent on coverage if you're under the age of 23. More likely, and what I believe our rules say, is that you have to be a dependent under the age of 23. So you still have to be claimed as a dependent through your federal and state tax system. That means that if you're 22, you're probably going to be a student. So as long as, again, you're a dependent on your parents' income tax under the age of 23, then we'll consider that as part of the family.
Thank you.
Mr. Naughton, did you have comments for the record?
Madam Chair, members of the committee, George Naughton with the Department of Administrative Services. We actually do not have anything to add to what Mr. King has already said.
Thank you very much. Are there any... Representative Smith, good afternoon.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair. When a shortage occurs, when the state underpays and we end up sending a check, do we also send that with interest? Do we pay them interest for the lack of money that they've had over a period of time?
Madam Chair, Representative Smith, no, we do not include interest to them, nor do we require that they generally pay interest to us.
Okay. So the inverse is holds as well. Thank you.
And Chair, if I could add, these are, even if there is an underpayment or overpayment, irrespective, generally, most of these folks are struggling. We work out, for example, if somebody should have been at they get a 95% subsidy and we find out it should have been at a 90, we by law have to go get that 5%.
Sure.
But we work out with them based on their income long-term payback arrangements. They're not taking this money and going and buying new, Rolls Royces. These are struggling families. They're just trying to put food on their table, and whether it's our heir or their heir, we try to work with them the best we can.
I appreciate that sensitivity, because a lot of folks, through perhaps just a simple mistake, could find themselves upside down, and I think you hit this right on the head. There's a lot of folks who are struggling, and we need to be sensitive of that. Thank you.
Any further comments, Mr. King?
Thank you, Madam.
Mr. Britton?
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, our intention with this bill is to only do a public hearing today on this bill. This would be a vehicle for including an amendment that might change the upper federal poverty level or the income level under which someone would qualify for FEOP in the event that the Assembly decides to increase the CHIP program up to 200%. We would want to include an amendment with this bill that would do the same for FEOP. Because the two programs are interrelated and because we get CHIP funding for this program. So for now, our plan is to hold off on moving this particular bill, but that's the reason we would wait until we have further clarification on the Children's Health Insurance Program.
All right. Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on House Bill 2189?
I don't know.
Then we will close the hearing on House Bill 2189 and open a hearing on House Bill 2160 relating to Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. This is a public hearing and possible work session. Mr. Britton. you want to start us off here?
Hey, hold on.
Okay.
I'd like to be. You want?
I'll let you out of here.
Thank you.
Mr. Britton and members, we have a couple of people who need to be excused before 2 p.m., so we would like to be able to get to the work session on House Bill 5031. What I'm going to suggest we do is gavel out of House Bill 2160, close that hearing, and open a hearing on House Bill 5031. I'm sorry, open a work session on House Bill 5031, which is the Insurance Pool Governing Board, and we'll go back to House Bill 2160 after we complete that.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Okay. Certainly.
Thank you.
And Mr. Britton will walk us through what we need to do. For those of you concerned about our chair, she is resting at home, and we hope to see her back really soon. I don't want her to think that I or that we forgot about Rosie and Rosette, so I'm going to mention them. And remember, they take no coins. Mr. King.
Madam Chair, at the last in our initial hearing on our bills, I just offered to make a donation at the end.
All right.
And not worry about it every time.
I'm just carrying on the tradition of this committee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Members, on Friday I distributed a memorandum on this particular budget to each of you, and I did not include a spreadsheet because at that time we were still working out our final numbers. Since then, we have met with the agency, and this spreadsheet that I just handed out shows you the adjustments that I'm recommending you make to this particular budget, and I'd like to walk you through those. The governor's printed budget is on line one. It is about 59.1 million total funds, 47 positions, 46.5 FTE. The first recommendation I am making is to remove out of what is in the other funds expenditure limitation about $38.5 million and to create a separate other funds limitation, which really represents federal funds that are coming from the Department of Human Services to the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program. This will allow everyone, the agency, and for us to track those funds separately from the other funds that the agency has. So we'll be creating a new other funds expenditure limitation. That's what line two is doing. Obviously, you can tell, as you heard during the public hearings, that these folks receive a fairly sizable amount of federal match that was allowed through the OHP2 waiver process and allowed this program, or will allow this program, to expand considerably. Lines three and four are technical reductions related to the Attorney General rate reduction and the Department of Administrative Services assessment reductions. You can see that they are composed both of general fund and other funds that are federal funds coming from the Department of Human Services. Lines 5 and 6 are a merit freeze adjustment, about $17,000 of general fund $21,300 of other funds, again, federal funds from DHS. We removed inflation increase savings, and that amounted to about $97,000 total funds. I'm recommending that you use $2,754 of other fund revenue that would have gone to finance some of that inflation instead to replace general fund. That's on line 7. Lines 8 and 9 were in the co-chair's budget. This is using $600,000 of an other fund ending balance of about $728,000. $600,000 of that to replace general fund, and then the co-chairs cut $3 million of general fund from this budget. The other funds as federal funds, 7.9 are the match associated with that $3 million cut. Now, when we presented this to leadership last week, their recommendation or what they wanted to do was to move this budget, but come back to that $3 million cut and associated federal funds in their negotiations. If they ultimately decide to add money back to replace that $3 million cut, it could be added in a Christmas tree bill at the end of session. So that is still in negotiations at this point. LFO recommendations are on lines 10, 11, and 12. I'll start with 11 and 12 first and then come back to line 10. First of all, there are some additional tobacco settlement carryover that the agency had allocated to them for the 0103 biennium. There's about $1.5 million left over, and we are suggesting that we use those funds to replace general fund. Line 12 is to use recently passed congressional bill that would give all states some enhanced Medicaid match. This agency receives some Medicaid funds, and this is their share of that enhanced Medicaid match rate, the $242,000. Now, back to line 10. During the public hearing on this budget, the agency came forward, I believe with the governor's support, to add 17 positions. This was the amount associated with the Oregon Health Plan 2 waiver, and they were not technically included in the governor's printed budget, but the agency asked for these. In negotiations with them, they have said that they could get by with 5 additional positions, at least for the short term, until they see how this program rolls out in the 0305 biennium. They did not request additional funding for those 17 positions, so I am suggesting that any vacancy savings which they might be able to accrue be used to fund those additional 5 positions. Thus, on line 14, our proposed budget would be about $15.1 million general fund, $2.1 million other funds, $30.8 million of the separate other fund limitation. These are, again, federal funds from the Department of Human Services. Total budget, nearly $48 million, 52 positions, 51.5 FTE.
Are there any questions or comments for Mr. Britton? The chair will accept a motion to approve the LFO.
Senator Morse.
Oh, I'm sorry. Oh, Senator Morse.
I'm sorry. I'm a little bit perplexed in the request for positions without any request for funding and how that plays out and where those monies are coming from if, in fact, the positions are going to be filled.
Madam Chair and Senator Morse, the funding for those positions either comes from vacancy savings, that is, holding other positions that are funded, the 47, for example, that they have in the governor's printed budget, hold those open, or they come from savings elsewhere, either in program or services and supplies.
A different kind of request, Madam Chair, than we've seen.
Other comments? Representative Westland.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Question. Not available, Mr. King. Rocky, looking at this LFO recommendation, maybe George wants to chip in here as well, but primarily for you, sir. We look at these reductions. I think you've heard the state of intent that that we will continue to look at this. My question is, and I want to phrase this appropriately, my question is, if all of a sudden we pass this budget out both floors, governor signs tomorrow and the session ends on Wednesday. You're predicting Wednesday, right?
Thursday.
Session ends on Thursday. Is there enough critical mass in this budget for you to make it at these levels? And let me just editorialize a little bit, because I think this is one of the most important budgets that we do. That there is, you know, it's pretty mundane. There's a lot of minutiae. It's not well understood. But you look at the impact of lives that are covered, and the way you do it, compliments to you, sir. Thank you for the work you do. Can you make this thing work, Rocky, if everything blows up tomorrow and we adjourn on Friday?
Madam Chair, Representative.
I don't know if that's a nice question or a hard question or, you know, a nasty question, but I'm looking at this and I'm just going, based on what I know you do and how you've done it over the years, this is a budget that has to be, not lavishly, but certainly appropriately funded.
Madam Chair, Representative Westland, I told my staff that the joke I was going to tell today was, if I didn't give enough funding, do I have the authority to have a bake sale to raise funds? The legislature, Oregon citizens, do not have enough money to fund everybody who doesn't have health insurance. So no matter what you give, whether it's the Medicaid program or whether it's the Family Health Insurance Assistance Program, we know that we're going to be short of funds. That's a reality in today's environment. I have under the budget that is before you today, the ability to serve on average about 10 to 11,000 Oregonians. That's all. I have about 5,300 that are enrolled today, another 1,600 that have been approved for enrollment, and another 1,300 that are in-house that were pending getting information from their employers and setting up. So I'm almost, you know, if everybody works out, at three-quarters of where I could be. The $3 million that you talked about, or the committee staff talked about, would allow us to add an additional probably $400 to $4,500 on, because we would be adding on what's called an expansion population and getting a better match rate, 72% federal, 28%, so we'd be at about 15,000. Our focus has been on group coverage because it is about a third to a half the cost of individual coverage. But of the 135,000 folks between 100 and 200% of poverty, only probably about 20 to 25,000 of those have group coverage available. So I guess, Representative Westland, as you know, no matter what we do here today, we can't meet the need. But what we do here today is important for the 10, 12, 15,000 folks out there that get in line. I have a waiting list of about 8 or 9, 10,000 folks on the individual market right now, that if we had enough money, we could double, triple the enrollment tomorrow. The reality is, we just don't. I don't know if that answers your question.
That gets to the heart of what I was trying to ask. Thank you, Rocky. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Representative Smith. Scott, I'm sorry.
thank you, Madam Chair. I had a couple questions, but because I'm entering the process late and I don't have this information. What was this budget last year, or last biennium? Just round figure.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, it was about $17 to $20 million in that range, and it's going upwards to, under the Legislative Fiscal Office recommendation, it will be about $50 million, $48
million. May I elaborate on that, Madam Chair?
Please.
When we started out, 2 years ago, the same table, this budget was not, or this agency was not able to receive federal match. So we were funding this budget with about $20 million of tobacco settlement money. During the course of the last biennium, one of the positive things that happened was the ability to get federal match on these funds. So that's why the budget in October or November of last year increased significantly, because we were informed by the federal government that our waiver was approved and we could get federal match. So the budget ended up about $38 million, I want to say, somewhere in that vicinity, because of the federal match that we were able to get late in the biennium.
Did you have a follow-up, Representative Scott?
So then, in fairness to Senator Morris's comment, that's probably where the funds come to finance the other five FTEs that are being requested, is because it was in there from a Fed match, and then apparently that's why you're changing this category to increase that before you went to the e-board last year, I'm gathering. Is that fair appraisal?
Well, Madam Chair and Representative Scott, at the time we made a recommendation to the emergency board, which they approved, we did establish a new other fund similar to this. But the budget bill, as it was presented here, 5031, has only one other fund's expenditure limitation, and we're recommending dividing that into two for the federal funds. But again, to finance unfunded positions, you have to find it somewhere, and you have to find it either in S&S or vacancy savings from other positions, or ultimately from program dollars if you have no other place to get them from.
Okay. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. And just if I could, Madam Chair.
Please.
Obviously, money doesn't grow in trees and it has to come from someplace, but I think Rocky, and maybe just as importantly, perhaps more importantly, his entire staff. I mean, at the end of the day, the vast majority of these are program dollars. I mean, they're not S&S or position dollars. And I mean, what they're doing is putting dollars functionally into premiums for working Oregonians and are able to afford health insurance either through FEOP or OMIP. So there's long story short, these guys, I think, have one of the highest conversion rates of dollar to program versus administration of anyone in state government, and for that there'd be compliment. I'm not trying to take umbrage with your point. I think it's a legitimate question, but these guys do a great job at actually getting the dollars on the ground.
Thank you.
The chair will accept a motion to approve the LFO budget.
So moved.
Representative Smith.
Let me get Schrader.
That's right. Okay.
It's not.
This is part.
That's where this comes from.
We'll be at ease for a few minutes while we wait for Senator Schrader.
Mark is wrong. 10 minutes.